Welcome back to another edition of Extreme Jeans. Of course, our website, extremejeans.com, for everything you need to know about what's happening in family history around the world this week. I am Fisher, your host, and I am delighted to be on the line with Elder Ed Jones and Sister Donna Jones. They are Mormon missionaries in San Diego. And what a miracle I've been hearing you two had last week or two in your own pursuits. Fill us in.
We were sitting in our office one morning. It was actually a Tuesday morning, and the phone rang. A lady I heard on the phone talking to Brother Jones saying she had a Bible she'd like to donate. This is not an unusual occurrence. Normally, we do not take donations because we are really very short on space for our library. And when I heard him talking to her, I said to him, may I talk to her? She might have a family history documentation in that Bible. Took the phone. I talked to her. She said she does have a family history notations inside the Bible. I said, well, if you'll bring it in, we'll take a look at it. Well, she brought it in the very next day with a young friend of hers and laid it on the counter. It was probably a 15-pound Bible. It was quite large, very old, and I'll let Brother Jones describe it to you.
All right.
Yeah, well, it was really a funny sight because here was this lady. She was no giant, and she had carrying very carefully, wrapped up in a pillowcase, this large object. And she actually sort of struggled getting it up onto the counter. And it was quite interested in. And she identified herself and said, well, here's the Bible. And I called for Donna, and we opened up the pillowcase and pulled it out on the counter, and there was this object about, as Sister Jones said, about 12 inches by 18 inches, and I swear the thing must have weighed at least 15 pounds. It looked like it had been at least through two wars and had the less of the experience, but knowing where most of the history was, we were quite anxious to open things up, and I very carefully opened up the cover, and it was detached from the rest of the book, so mm-hmm. I was really having to be very, very careful. And we opened up the cover, and then we opened up the next page, and then it happened.
I looked at the names on the page as they were bantering and talking about the old Bible, and I just about dropped my teeth right there, because every name on the first, second, and third page had the name of Hammond. Hammond is a very strong line on my husband's side of our family.
The interesting thing about those pages, though, was the first impression. Normally, when you look into a family Bible, you notice distinct handwriting styles and so forth. Usually, they're quite hard to read and a real hassle. This thing, my gosh, it looked like it was done by a professional. And it looked like an old monk's writing. It was old English scroll, very, very professionally done. And then when we looked at that top entry on it,
I said to my husband, "You won't believe this, dear. Take a look at these names."
Right. And the thing started off with a marriage record, and the marriage record was dated 1791, May 24th, 1791, and as my wife said, it was Hammond. And then it listed every one of the Hammond children in that particular family and the date on which they were born.
And then the next page we looked at showed not only some of the children, but some of their children. We had literally a record in front of us of about three full Hammond families. Now, the interesting part about that, and Brother Jones will tell you about the rest of the Bible, but the interesting part about that Hammond family was I immediately took made copies of those pages and began researching those names. Of course, that's what I wanted to do. I found that most of the children on the first page had deceased as children. But there were some who had grown to adulthood, and it was those adulthood children whose children I found on the other pages. Then I started researching in Family Search the adult names. I actually found those names scattered through Family Search, never in the same place. But they were usually somebody's spouse, not connected to
right.
the same Hammond surname.
Yeah, meanwhile, back at the ranch, we were enthralled with the book itself. You can't believe this book. First of all, as we opened up to the front page, it wasn't the title page, but it was the front page. It was a page that named the illustrator and was both sides, both pages, the facing page and the basic page, were these beautiful etchings, the biblical etchings and so forth, that and they announced who the artists were and so forth, and the date for the illustrations was 1812. Now, that was wonderful, but we had to get to the real page, and we flipped over to the next page, which was really the title page and so forth, and found out that this was not only a standard Bible that had the Old and New Testament in it, but it was a special Bible in that it had the Apocrypha in it.
Really?
And it had evangelical comments, as they called them.
It was compiled by a Reverend Joseph Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T. There are probably two that we have found in the United States. One is in Chicago in a library not allowed to be loaned out. And apparently we had the second one.
So this is very rare.
Yeah, the other two, they do make modern-day copies of them, but the other two we found, one was in England, the other one was in Africa. Now, those Hammond names that we found within the Bible that I did research, because of the Bible, I was able to take those names in Family Search and literally create three complete new families that were connected to our line.
Was this a wall for you? Was this a brick wall?
Yes, it was. And I'll tell you, it was not only a brick wall broken for us, but there were other members, other patrons from the church in this area who would come and look at the Bible who also had Hammond ancestry. One of them actually was related to one of the spouses of one of these Hammond children listed in the Bible.
Right. It was a gentleman. It was just, you know, we were showing off the Bible like we always do. showing in the lines on there and so forth, and he was tracing down some of the names, and he saw an Atkins, and he looked at the date on the Atkins and the name on the Atkins, and he says, "My gosh, that's in my line. I know that person."
And
no
we were
kidding.
Able to find his line with that Hammond, again, connected to our line on Family Search.
It's a very special story, though, about how the person who brought it to you actually obtained this Bible in order to bring it to you. Fill us in on that.
Yes, I'd be glad to. That was the most wonderful miracle of all. The Whitlock family, Mrs. Gwen Whitlock, is the person who brought the Bible in. She did not tell us that day how she happened to come by the Bible, but her husband, Pastor Carl Whitlock, reminded her, and she called us the very next day and said, "My husband reminded me to tell you how we acquired the Bible." Early in the 1970s, over 40 years ago, an elderly neighbor of theirs had been doing his morning stroll through a Southern California alleyway, and he happened to find the Bible stuck out in a trash can. He picked it out of the trash can, had no reason to keep it, took it to his friends, the Whitlocks, and they kept it in their possession for over 40 years. They would bring it out every Christmas just for a decoration because it was an antique relic. But Pastor Whitlock would take it to his church and his congregation on a yearly basis when they'd bring it out and to see if they could find anybody connected to the Hammond family whose names were contained in the Bible. Over 40 years, every time they took that to the congregation, they could find no one who was connected to that family. And when Mrs. Whitlock brought it to the library, I kid you not, she stood there with all of us, tears in her eyes as well as ours. I had an amazing conversation with the two of them when we were asked to get more information on the Whitlocks. I went to their home. They graciously received me. I promised Pastor Whitlock that we owed him. And because he found that Bible and they were so kind to donate it to the Family Search Library and find our ancestry, I was going to help him track down what happened to his Whitlock genealogies.
What an amazing story. Thank you so much, Elder Ed Jones, Sister Donna Jones, for sharing your miracle with us. What a great story. And Elder Jones was telling me yesterday when I was setting this whole thing up that he's making plans on putting together a display with a glass case and maybe a little video tale, because this is something that's going to be talked about, especially where you are, for a long, long time. And coming up for you on our next segment of Extreme Genes today, very excited to have Ron Fox and Brock Bierman on. These are both experts in antique photographs. Now, if you have any old photos that go back maybe to the 1800s, 1880s, 1890s, you can't recognize who people are, maybe you want to try to match them up. Maybe you have somebody you think, well, that might be Aunt Margaret, but I have this other picture and I'm not sure. There's now a technology that will help you know within a great degree of certainty if that is or isn't the same person. So you're going to want to stay tuned for that segment coming up. Don't forget also you can leave your questions, your comments on our Extreme Genes Find Line at 1-234-56-GENES, and we'd love to hear from you. It's Extreme Genes Family History Radio. Welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio. It is Fisher here, and my guest this evening, a couple of guys that I'm just absolutely blown away by with what they can do with photographs. And a while back, about 2 years ago, I was in search of a picture of my great-grandfather. I had pictures of his parents, pictures of his siblings, pictures of his children, but none of him because he was, well, a bit of a scoundrel. And from my research, I kind of came to the conclusion that they must have thrown his pictures out because he had women here and women there, and he was involved with Tammany Hall in New York City. It wasn't a pretty picture, but nonetheless, the picture I was looking for was him. And I discovered that he had been a New York City volunteer fireman and started through digitized newspapers to track a trip that these guys took from New York City to San Francisco in 1887. And they went from a train across the country, stopping in all the major cities, and paraded with the local fire departments in each place. And as a result, I decided to take the trip with them and got all the digitized clippings from each town, and just to see what I could learn about the group and perhaps my ancestor as an individual. And lo and behold, there were three different places that did a little something unique on him. One was in Omaha, one was in New York City, and one was in Salt Lake City. All stops along the way on this trip. The Salt Lake City one indicated that he had sent a photograph after the trip to a former colleague who was in Salt Lake City, a former New York City fireman, and along with some thanks for the hospitality they had enjoyed while making that stop on their route to San Francisco. So I was kind of shocked to know that there was a photograph floating around of him in the Salt Lake City area. So I contacted my friend, Ron Fox, who is my guest. Hi, Ron. How are you?
Good morning.
And Ron ran off to the Historical Society in Salt Lake City, Utah, to try to find something. We didn't have a lot of luck there, but he said, you know, the word is there might be something up at This Is the Place Heritage Park. And that's where the Mormon pioneers came into the Salt Lake Valley in 1847, and they'd kind of recreated Old Salt Lake. They had the old Fireman's Hall there. And to make this long story a little less long, basically I found a photograph of the group that traveled to San Francisco on the wall, and it had the only key known to exist that had the names of all the people, along with a number next to them. And we were able to spot a little number on each figure that had been written in, and I found this photograph of my great-grandfather after 30 years of searching. It was unbelievable. Ron, you were instrumental in that. And that is because Ron is an expert in photographs and how they work. Our other guest is Brock Bierman with a great company called PhotoFaceMatch.com. And if you were ever at Roots Tech, the incredible convention that's put on in Salt Lake City every year. You might have seen this year. Brock, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Scott. It's nice to be here, and hello to everyone from Koblenz, Germany, where it's actually evening here.
Koblenz, Germany. Now, you were talking to me earlier this week as we were setting this up from Belgium. What are you doing over there?
Well, I'm doing a little family research. We were in Belgium, where I traced my Belgian ancestry, and now I'm tracing my German ancestry in the Koblenz area. They immigrated to the United States in the 1700s.
Well, photofacematch.com is this amazing new product that Brock and his people have put together to help you match up photographs of people when they were young and maybe when they were old or maybe in a certain situation. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. But the one thing I've learned about photographs, guys, is that basically when you find one, especially of somebody that you've come to know after a long, long time of researching, it's a game changer, isn't it?
It absolutely is. I mean, to be able to look into the eyes of an individual and see your traits, your similarities in how you looked, that certainly was the case in your case when we looked at the picture of your great-grandfather with his fireman helmet on, but there was still the Fisher look.
Yes, I could see some traits there. And in fact, it led to a second picture because we were able to match it up and recognize that this was the same person. In fact, Brock, we could have probably used your technology on it. And maybe for a demonstration, we'll put that on our website, extremejeans.com.
Yeah, we're excited about our new technology. We think it's going to break down a lot of brick walls and help people identify their ancestors not only at different ages, but we also think it will help find their ancestors in other people's photographs.
Well, and you and Ron both deal with the same issues, and that is helping people identify. Most photographs are just not identified. They're not marked.
That's really the truth. In fact, you know, just to give just a quick history, photographs came about 1839 as far as Daguerre in France made the public announcement. And there was an American in that crowd that day, and his name was Samuel F.B. Morse. Now, Morse was much more well-known for his invention of the telegraph.
And the dats and the dots.
The dats and the dots. And he's the one that in about 1840 brought it to America, and it just grew like wildfire. We had a process called the daguerreotype, and that was a copper plate that was coated with silver, which could get you an image of yourself, which was a marvel of science. And it was really looked at as a chemical process and a scientific process. So it was quite interesting. But, you know, it cost the average person $5. And back then, that was a week's wage.
Wow. Really? $5? That's actually more than you would pay for one now, even under today's economy,
yes,
by a long, long way.
And daguerreotypes were actually they lived for a short while. But in the 1840s to about 1845, they really were a big hit. And then they moved to a cheaper process called an ambrotype. An ambrotype was a process where chemicals were placed on glass, and the glass became the negative as well as the positive. And what they did was they added a black sheet of paper or a black piece of fabric behind it to give it the contrast so you could see it. But if you held it up to the, you know, took it out of its case and held it up to the light, it would be a negative. So it was a really interesting process. And that basically went through the Civil War and into the 1880s.
So most of the Civil War photos we see are ambrotypes?
Ambros or daguerreotypes. Daguerreotypes kind of faded out about 1855. But some people should also look at, we became a society where people wanted color even in that period of time. And the daguerreotypes were, they developed an art called a colorist. And the colorist would take a very fine brush because these plates were not very big. You know, most of them, they called a full plate was like 6 inches by 8 inches. But then most of them were sixth plate or ninth plates, which really made them small that you could carry. But the point is, people would actually paint in, you know, blushes and the color of their eyes and maybe dot the buttons to make them gold on the picture just to enhance them.
Wow. So in the process then of all this, the challenge was always to identify them. Now, I would imagine because of the rarity of photographs at that time, people didn't mark them because they knew who they were. It was like probably the only photograph they owned, right?
Absolutely. And that is our biggest dilemma today. People want to know when they look in their collections, they want to know who is this and what time and where is it. So those questions can be answered by a number of different ways.
You know, I was just going to add that they're also a work of art, as you'd mentioned earlier. And, you know, I can remember my grandmother talking about some of these old photographs, and she would just be afraid to actually write on them. And I can remember her telling me the stories about her mother and her grandparents not actually wanting to write on them in fear of damaging. So you had not only the fact that they knew who they were, but also the fact that they were, you know, basically told not to write on them.
Now, how did you get into this whole thing with the technology, Brock?
Well, you know, I've been looking for photographs of my ancestors like you for the last 25 years as I've been involved with family history. But we all have that proverbial shoebox full of old photographs that are unnamed, and I have a load of them, tintypes, daguerreotypes, ambrotypes, CDVs, and the like, cabinet photographs. And so, you know, there were always photographs that I'd had in my collection that I had identified of people that were older, and I looked at the pictures of younger people that were unidentified, and I, you know, gosh, it looks just like that person, and there's got to be a way to be able to find out whether it is the right person. And I, about 5 years ago, I met, while I was working with government, a group of folks who invented a technology that's used in homeland security venues like airports or bus stations or nightclubs or in other types of secure locations. And they came to me to see if they would be interested in having it used in a loss prevention, or if you will, a space where people were looking for their relatives after a disaster, if you will. And so I dealt with them during that period of time. And then shortly after I left the government, I recontacted these folks and I just asked them if we could possibly look into see how we couldn't take photographs of people who were young and old and match them up. And they said they could do that. So that's kind of how we ended up where we are.
Wow. Well, we want to hear more about that and how it's used and where people can go to actually try this technology out. We're going to tell you all about it coming up next when we return on Extreme Genes. We are back. Extreme Genes. I am Fisher. We're in the middle of an incredible conversation here with Ron Fox, a photograph expert, and Brock Bierman from PhotoFaceMatch.com. And we were just finding out from Brock about how we started this company where you could identify people and determine the likelihood of them being the same people in pictures from way back in the day, maybe from the 1880s and then again from the 1940s. So, Brock, let's get into that a little deeper now. How does this technology work?
Scott, it's basically the same technology, the facial recognition technology that you would see in an airport. Where their security systems are matching up people that walk through the facility against known mugshots of people of interest. So, you know, I had met the developers of this technology some 5 years ago when I was working for government, as I mentioned, and I asked them if they could really translate this information into kind of a family history platform where we had taken old photographs, or two old photographs, if you will, one person at a time in their lives and then another at an older or younger time, and try to match them up. And they said we could, and we developed this technology, and we're offering it at PhotoFaceMatch.com. It's a free service right now. We're offering it for people to utilize, to play with, to see if they can basically use the technology to match up their photographs.
Wow. I mean, to me, it just blows my mind. I went to the site and saw how it works. I haven't plugged anything in yet, but we're going to link to that site on our site, which is extremegenes.com for photo face match. Now, I was looking at this. You got little circles around the eyes and the mouth. And is this something that we actually do? Do we try to match certain points?
No. But right now, what I need people to do is to really crop their photographs when they upload the photograph. And not to upload a photograph that's too large. We're looking for the smaller 1 megabyte in or around that area. If they upload a too big of a photograph, it'll freeze our system simply because we just don't have the capacity right now to handle large photographs. And we also ask them to crop the faces. Our technology really works based on the facial features. And I won't get into the mechanics of the actual software, but it will take the various aspects of your face and it will measure them in a three-dimensional program within the system and actually come out with a result and tell you whether the pictures are likely to be the same person.
So it gives, I remember there was a meter or something that says very likely, somewhat likely, possible, not likely, that type of thing, right?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Kind of on a percentage basis.
Right. And you know, right now we're working with face on face, but as we improve the technology, as we go down the line, we suspect we'll be able to take large photographs of teams, of group shots, of military yard longs. I mean, eventually we'd like to be able to scan large groups of people and pull people's faces out of it based on a single photograph that we're comparing it against.
It's a great process, and there are so many pictures that were taken because of the cost where they were group photos, not individual photos. And so, therefore, there's a great need for that.
So is blurriness an effect? Does it have an effect on the accuracy of the software, Brock?
Yeah, you know, the more detailed the photograph, the better the result's going to be. You know, ultimately, I think one of our real goals is to help people find their ancestors in other people's photographs. And
oh.
You know, you look at a company like Ancestry.com that has probably hundreds of millions of photographs that are uploaded by their subscribers. And if we integrate that software, I'm sure that we're going to find subscribers finding their ancestors in other people's photographs. And we're really at a much higher percentage of certainty when it comes to matching people when they're closer in age. So the closer in age they are, right, the better the result's going to be. And, you know, I think that clearly with the hundreds of millions of photographs Ancestry or MyHeritage or any number of these other sites have, we're going to start making a lot of matches.
Wow. And this is where it's all going. Unbelievable stuff, Brock. Now, Ron, you help people match photographs by using more, I would say, traditional clues, which includes what? Dress, the type of photograph that it is, the time period.
That's right. You know, you look at different time periods, and we've talked about albilums and daguerreotypes. And then, of course, that was followed by what we'd call an albilum print that was a paper print, which started during the Civil War just before. And then the tintype, which became a much cheaper image that could be reproduced. And sometimes a photographer would actually put a honeycomb over their lens so they could get multiple copies of the same image that they were taking a picture of. So if you get a picture of Abraham Lincoln on a tintype, the likelihood if it wasn't a copy, he actually sat in front of that piece of tin. So
wow.
It's a big deal. Yeah, and believe it or not, there are many ways in which to tell who these people are. As a personal example, I had a what they call ruby glass daguerreotype, which was actually, or ambrotype, that was printed on a dark red glass. And so the positive was a negative, and it was very interesting. But behind that, hidden behind that in that wooden case was his proposal to his wife in October of 1865.
Whoa.
Which is a nice addition.
Yeah. And nobody knew that was there till you found it.
That's correct. And you know, there's a lot of things hidden behind those photographs. Tintypes, on the other hand, are very difficult because you can't write on them. Pencil wouldn't work. Pen wouldn't work because they were just metal. But when you came to paper or cardboard, when an albilum print was put on a piece of paper on a cardboard, people could write their names, but unfortunately, 90% of the time, they didn't.
They
so
did
what
not.
We looked at were several things. First off, it's just like as the process goes in a much less sophisticated way that Brock does, is you look at the ears, you look at the eyes, you look at the nose. For example, we have one in our family that has a trait that I've got a picture of a woman born in 1812, and I can look at my grandchildren, and that same difference in our eyes are so strong in that one line from the genes, the extreme gene.
Yes.
That it really carries forward. But let me tell you, there are thousands and thousands of photos, for example, on eBay every day. And there are daguerreotypes, there are albilums, there are tintypes. And, you know, every once in a while you find one that is unidentified that you might recognize. And that discovery is exciting. earlier this year, a friend of mine brought me a daguerreotype that he bought in a collection from a fairly well-known family. And that photograph was recently sold in major six figures.
Whoa.
To an institution. And so there are many times where you can find great photographs. Another friend of mine found one a couple of, well, actually 30 years ago, but it now sits in the National Archives and considered one of the five finest photographs in American history. It's of Frederick Douglass speaking at a 1840s abolitionist meeting in New Hampshire, and one person offered $1 million for that photo. So
Brock, I got to ask you then, do you see this this technology then working for establishing the identity of historic figures?
Absolutely. I think that not only will we be able to identify individuals, but we'll also be able to incorporate other characteristics other than faces into our technology. You were talking about the hairstyle. You were talking about what they're wearing. And, you know, it just had me thinking that our technicians have already been thinking about how we incorporate those characteristics into our software. So it's calculating more than just the face, but it's also calculating the items and that they're wearing, the jewelry, the houses, the style of hairstyle or the style of dress and ties. So there's a lot of different opportunities that go beyond just the face for the technology.
One quick thing, you know, during the period, especially the earlier period, many of the people who had their photos taken would add something that was relative to their occupation. So a lot of times you could tell a carpenter would be holding a hammer, a soldier would be holding a rifle or a gun. And, of course, the Civil War uniform pictures are always fascinating. It's a really good clue when you see someone holding a particular object that was something that was actually their trade.
And so you would go and research the individual, find out what their occupation was, and you'd have a pretty good clue of who you were looking at.
That's right. And a lot of times you'd find that in the back of these daguerreotypes or ambrotypes or even the albilums, they would always say, you know, who the manufacturer is of the either the case or the photographer themselves. And, of course, you can go online today and find out where that photographer took his pictures, the period of time that he took his pictures, and even the location down to the street address.
All right. So, Brock, the question for you is, will this technology start to identify potentially the age range of the subject of the photograph and help us that way?
Absolutely. And, in fact, as I mentioned again, identifying the clothes and the backgrounds and other material, we also think we can incorporate a scanning technology to help us with the photographers. As Ron just mentioned, photographers, you know, basically they put their logo on the front, they put their names on the front. We start collecting that data, and we're going to be able to pinpoint exact times and places.
This is exciting stuff, guys.
I just want to tell you, I think that this is long since coming. We've needed this technology for a while. We're going to push the envelope. We're going to make it better, and we appreciate people's input. We want to hear from you. Let us know exactly what's working, what's not working, and we're going to make it better.
And Ron has offered the same. If you need a little help on maybe dating an old photograph, getting some historic background on it. Ron Fox, Brock Bierman, thank you so much for joining us this week. I mean, I wish we had 9 hours to get into this because this is really exciting stuff, but we will have you back again, and we'll continue to explore. Tom Perry from the Multimedia Center with incredible information about how you can preserve your audio coming up next on Extreme Genes. Welcome back to Extreme Genes, extremegenes.com. It is Fisher here. I've got Tom Perry back in the studio from the Multimedia Center. And Tom not only does the home movies, the videos, but he does amazing things with audio. And in fact, Tom, you took a movie I had with sound, I mean, from the 1930s, and digitized that for me with my father playing in a big band in 1936. And I was just so amazed that you were able to capture all the audio just like off the film strip. Unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing, all the different kinds of film technologies out there. We can do the kind that either has a magnetic strip or the optical strip. And it's usually 16mm or Super 8. But we actually had one time when one of the local anchors, when he was young, he made a movie on 8mm and wanted sound. So he took it to some place and they laid down a magnetic strip for him and he put audio on it. And when he brought it in for us to transfer, I'm going, no, this is 8. This can't have audio on it. And it did. He had a machine that played it. And so we rigged up his machine into our system so that we could get the audio to it. It's like the craziest thing I've probably ever seen in 8mm. It's the only 8mm I've ever seen that audio, but it was all done post. It's incredible.
Now, back in 99, I read an article in USA Today that said, gee, it's a shame there are no videos, there's no movies of the play-by-play of the World Series between the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Yankees. And it said the more astounding thing is there's no audio of that. Well, that kind of was a surprise to me because I had some audio of that had been given to me by a former stepfather of mine who had grown up in Brooklyn, worked in radio, and he actually gave me some tape from 1952 that they'd rolled right off the board for Armed Forces Radio at that time. And so I was able to actually rescue that, and you've digitized that for me. And what kind of things can you save?
We could do just about anything. I mean, we have five-cylinder machines, and when we talk about that, people say, well, what do you mean a cylinder machine? Back before vinyl records and wire records, they had these cylinders that were made out of wax, and it was called an Edison cylinder machine.
I think every antique store I've ever been in has a little bucket of those things. They're pretty common, though, aren't they, even though they're very old?
Oh, yeah, because they are common. The biggest thing you have to be careful, if you keep it in an attic or a barn, they'll melt because they are made out of wax. But I tell people, if you ran into them, you never know what's on it. There could be, you know, some famous president or somebody that's on that just doesn't even know it exists. So anytime I have customers say, hey, I've got these things, I don't want them, do you want them? Yeah, give them to me. Same thing with old photographs. Don't throw them away. Give them to me. You know, if you don't know who they are and they're old pictures, we might be able to find out who they belong to. So bring them in. We can run them through our machine, and it might be something dumb, but it might be something absolutely incredible that nobody knows even exists anymore.
Now, what have you found in some of these?
Mostly just people talking and people singing, usually poorly, and stuff like that.
It's just not a professional recording like they did, because they used to have, you know, the great opera singers, and they would sell these just like records were sold in the 60s and CDs much later. So you're saying these are personal recordings maybe that were in families.
Oh, yeah. Most of the ones we've had come in are like that. I haven't had any professional ones come in, but I'm sure they're out there. And you never know. Like, for instance, we had somebody bring in some old reel-to-reel tape, and they didn't know what it was. They had no idea, no way to play it. And so we transferred it, and it was Bill Cosby. And when we told them, yeah, it was Bill Cosby, and they go, oh, that's too bad. I go, wait. This Bill Cosby is so old. This was before he was famous. This could actually be worth something. Don't be feeling bad about it right now. You might be able to sell it on eBay for, you know, and pay for your whole job.
So we've also talked about wire recordings. Now, I've never seen any of that. I don't even know what it looks like. Can you describe wire recordings? Because some people have these. They must bring them to you.
Oh, yeah. It's just on a little spool, just like if you've ever been fishing. It looks just like fishing wire, but instead of being made out of the Mylar type stuff, it's made out of wire. And it could be gold wire, tin wire, different kinds of wire. And to look at it, just looks like, you know, super thin, you know, wire. But it's actually a recording. And people have brought those in and says, do you know what this thing is? And it's a wire recording. And because it's made out of metal, the sound is incredible. When we're transferring, it's like the person standing right next to you and talking to you. It's better than vinyl. It's better than wax. It's better than, you know, a lot of stuff we have today. But it was really expensive to do wire recording now, besides being so hard to work with. You know, it's very expensive.
So what era are we talking about?
I honestly don't know. There's no labels usually on it that has a year, but I'd say probably the early 19s, maybe even some into the 18s. I don't know for sure.
That far back?
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is old stuff. And it's incredible. The sound is amazing, but the machines are very temperamental. You have to stand there while you're doing it. You can't, like, walk away and multitask. You have to stand there while the bobbin's going up and bent down. And the funny thing is, if it splices, if you're a Boy Scout and know how to tie knots, that's how you splice it back together. Just put a fish line type knot right on it.
So it'll jump a little, obviously, when you do that.
Yeah, more than a little.
Because the speed's pretty slow?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's actually on a little, like a bobbin almost type thing, like on a sewing machine. It's going up and down, so the wire will lay itself down evenly. But sometimes the bobbins go out, and you're having to do it by hand, and you can't buy parts from them, obviously. And so we get them and try to steal parts off of other ones. Like,
wow. So what have you heard on some of these?
Mostly just people talking.
And so a lot of this stuff we actually see online now.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's been rescued. But these originals have to have certain value to it as well.
Oh, they do. Don't ever throw anything away not knowing what it is, because it could be something that's been lost forever that some family's been looking for that doesn't think exists. Like I mentioned last week, we had somebody that, you know, their home burned down. They lost all their photos. They lost everything. They happened to be at a neighbor's house watching some video eights that we had transferred for them, and they saw it was only 5 minutes of their wedding, and that's all they have now. So they had the person make a copy for them. That's all they have left of their wedding. So if you have something, don't throw it away, especially old photographs.
What about cassettes? Now, those were popular from about the 60s up till CDs came in.
Right. We
there are a lot of those, tons
absolutely.
Of those.
And they usually come in 30s, 45s, 60s, 90s, 120s. We do them all, and we also do the little micro cassettes. We've had people that make a little voice recording when somebody calls their house and that their spouse or one of their children has passed away, and that's the only recording they have of them. And so they bring those in, and we put them on a CD for them. So, you know, we can transfer just about anything. We have the little mini discs that they used to have, the old Walkmans that took the little teeny discs.
Yeah.
We do those, just about anything you can think of. We haven't had something that we haven't been able to do yet. But the biggest thing, if anybody has something that's really strange, but they have the machine that was recorded on, like a laser disc, bring in your machine, and we can tie it into our system and still get it transferred.
I have something real strange. I wonder if you've ever seen a record about this big. It's about 2 feet wide.
The giant ones.
It was done in a studio back in the 40s when my father was recording in big bands and the like. Never been able to do anything with that because what needle can drop on anything that's that broad? Have you ever dealt with those?
That's one thing we haven't been able to do because all the players we've been able to find aren't the free-floating arms. There's a place where they loop down in a U, but every once in a while I talk to old radio stations and look for them, and one day I know we're going to find one. And then once we have it, then rock and roll. But, yeah, those things are so big. They were literally long playing albums. They were so large, but, you know, the arm is the problem right now. And hopefully they're going to release a laser soon where they'll be read by light instead of a needle. So then if you have cracks and missing parts and stuff, you can still get, you know, what you want out of it. Exactly. Like the old, you know, you're probably too young to remember the old Kellogg's Corn Flakes when they had Christmas albums right on the box and you cut them off.
No, I remember that.
Yeah, they get old and cracked, so we can do stuff like that too. But once they release the lasers, that's going to change the whole industry.
Well, Tom Perry is changing a lot of people's lives doing this stuff from the Multimedia Center. Thanks for joining us again, Tom. We'll see you next week. I already think this show is too short. Too much good stuff to cover, and we've covered a ton of it today. Thanks once again to Brock Bierman and Ron Fox, our photo experts. Thanks also to the Joneses in San Diego for sharing with us their incredible story about the Bible of their ancestors brought to them by a stranger who had no idea it should be in their hand.
Extreme Genes, Family History Radio on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.